chance sometime. It's not, I don't, I think they're having it this year. They kind of postponed it last year. Y'all go to, if you've never been to Blade Show, y'all go to the Blade Show in Atlanta. It's usually in, the first weekend in June. I don't know when it's scheduled for this year, but got a lot of bushcraft stuff there, a lot of knives, and just a whole bunch of other people. It's the, it's the big one. It's where everybody all over the world comes to that one. I used to go almost every year, but I haven't been in several years now. But it's worth the trip to Atlanta to the, it's huge at the Cobb Galleria. The traffic is not terrible if you go, Friday morning yet. Since it's, it opens Friday about noon, I think, the general public, and then on 2 o'clock, and you get an early bird special and pay for tickets and get there. It opens about 10 or 11 for the early birds, maybe 12, but it's a lot of fun. And even if you go on a Saturday or Sunday, it's worth the trip up there just to see all the bushcraft stuff you got and all the dives and so forth. But that's a lot of fun. I still got some gear left over. I've got some of those billy pots and some other stuff, and I still run my gas stoves every once in a while as well. I don't do much burning of wood because I can't. When I was doing them, I was just going to be a trout fishing. I'd get four or five miles off a beaten path, and I'd carry a stove or something with me to heat me up, something to eat or something to drink. They don't want you burning your fires up in some parts of the back country. You may not, especially when it's real dry like it has been in years past. It's a lot of fun. Like I said, those skills are real handy. It's just amazing how well they translate to everyday stuff. N4DJ, C4ID.
Hey, Jim, ID. Yeah, the Blade Show, me and a friend of mine that run Georgia Bushcraft, he has two or three different little companies that he owns, and he goes to Blade Show every year, and he's been trying to get me to go help him run his booth, or he's offered me free passes, and I just never have been. I want to go one of these years. They're supposed to have it this year. He just signed up and got his booth last week. We were talking about it on our way out to Alabama. So, but yeah, it's the biggest in the world when it comes to knives and axes and anything with a sharp edge, that's for sure.
I've enjoyed it. I've been interested in knives for years. I've been custom knives probably the last 25 or so. I've owned a lot of different people over the years. My taste changed from time to time. Went from modern type folders, or I had some custom mayos. Tom built me some left-handed frame blocks. He built me three or four of them, I think, a number of years ago. And I had some, of course, like I said, I still have several of Tom Klein's knives. I've had stuff by Burt Foster, I got five or six of Reese's traditional folders, and I like those. Those are pretty handy. And I've gone back to that just traditionalized more than anything else. But I've had some of just about every decent maker over the last 20 years or so. And made a little money on some of them, but I'm familiar with Georgia Bushcraft. I'm not as familiar as I probably should be, but those guys out in where they're located now, but those guys that did the Fiddleback Forge when they first started up, those guys out there, I knew several of those guys, and the guy that makes leather for them, couple of guys still make leather for them, I guess, but I've had a few of those over the years. Those knives are a little thick for me, and I've got stuff stashed away. Me or my son does. I don't know. He may have a Dozier Bushcraft with a Scandi edge. It's a pretty good knife, but it's in D2, and I like D2 for a lot of stuff, but it's just a little. I prefer 01 or something like that. But I did have a crime bushcraft in In '82, it was a really good knife, but it wasn't a Scandi grind, which is, you know, which is what I prefer for that kind of work.
Knife I have that's my sort of bushcraft knife for the moment is one made by a guy named L.T. Wright out of Wrightsville, Ohio. And it's a GNS is the name of it, and it's a Scandi grind. It's got about a 4.5-5 inch blade somewhere right in there, and got a good handle on it. It does good for your bushcraft, and then I got a guy over there in Greenville, Dan Eastlum, does dogwood custom knives. And he was in the bushcraft for a while, a few years ago, and I got a little neck knife he made out of that super steel. And I'll tell you, that little knife is it's called a three-finger knife, and it's got one of the sharpest edges on it and can keep a sharp edge on it better than any knife I've ever had. So between those two, those are my go-tos. I've got several others like you. I've bought different ones over the years and enjoy them, but I've got my favorite two right now.
One of LT's knives somewhere around. Like I said, I'll keep them for a while. I either give them or sell them to my son. I basically give them to my son because he's got a big collection, and I've been a lot bigger than I have. I just keep a few. That's all I do now. I don't have a bunch of them. I just, you know, I get changed, and when my taste changes, I just move on to something else. But I've got one of LT Wright's knives somewhere, and I can't remember the name of it. It's a small knife. I don't think it may be about, gosh, I don't think it's more than 5.5 or 6 inches overall. But it was a good, really good knife, and it had a. I don't remember if that thing had a convex, it wasn't flat ground. I think it might have been a convex ground or something like that, but it was a good knife. It wasn't quite as, it was thin. It seemed like it might have been 3/32 blade stock, but I'm pretty sure it was O1 instead of A2. It's a really good knife. They were very expensive. I think that's when he was, it seems like he and somebody else were kind of in cahoots for a while, then they kind of parted ways. Is that, am I thinking about the same knife maker?
WHMID. Yeah, Jerry, they used to be, him and the other guy run a company called Blind Horse Knives, and they split, and Dan, not the one from South Carolina, started Battle Horse Knives, and LT started LT Wright Knives, and they're both in the general vicinity up there, but Blind Horse Knives, they're actually a collectible commodity now, because they just only did them for a few years before they split ways, so a lot of people try to collect the ones with the horse on them.
When I think the one I've got somewhere has got the horse on it, like I said, it was just a real small knife. It wasn't, you know, it was about like a patch knife or something like that. I don't remember what it called it. It had a name for it, but it was a real popular model for them. I think it was something like $60 or $70. It wasn't real expensive for a custom knife at all. But I've seen some of these other ones that people have used, and I've actually had a can't remember what it was, a martini. Might have been a martini, but it was I can't remember the brand of it. It was one of the finished knives, and it had I think it was called an Arctic Carver or something like that. It had a Scandi grinder. It had a big handle. That thing was sharp as all get out. And it was the Scandi grinders are just, you know, they're kind of specialty for that type of work. But it was by far one of the sharpest factory knives I've ever used, and it was about $40 or something like that. But the handle was really big on it, just a little bigger than I like to handle, you know, like to use on a knife like that. But I have to look up some of those other knives. I've heard that other that the the guy in Greenville. Seems like several years ago I heard he was making some knives, but I don't remember seeing many of them because I was kind of out of my area of interest at the time. N4DGC Friday.
His company is Dogwood Custom Knives by Dan Eastland. That's the guy in South Carolina. And Reliance Leatherworks, Matt Gillenwater made all of his sheaths back when they were together. They had a shop together there in Greenville for a couple, 3 years. Like I said, they got into the bushcraft knives, and Dan actually, if you're familiar with who Horace Kephart is, he was sort of a bushcraft legend back in the day, and his knife, their granddaughter, has one of the originals that was his, and Dan and one other knife maker actually got to hold it, use some calipers, and measure it, and did a limited run on remaking the Kephart knife. Did the sheath the same way. He made it off the original pattern, so they've done things like that. And now Dan is in the high-end kitchen knives and chef knives, things like that.
Kephart. Seems like his granddaughter or somebody was going to, they may have produced a TV, like a little documentary some years ago. We're starting on it about him, what he had to do with, helping get the park built in there. He was an absolute bill, but he was into everything. But I think he was, if I remember correctly, there's still, there's a one spot up there, I think, where they had one of his, had a chair or bench up there dedicated to him somewhere along the parkway, but I don't remember where it was now. This had been years and years ago, because my dad traveled up in the mountains when he was selling for, selling flour and staples like that to grocery stores back before the Depression. I'm about back during the Depression, I guess, before the war. But, he was telling me some of the stories up there, and it's pretty interesting. One of the guys I met along my travels that worked in Rome, Georgia, his grandfather helped build, he was one of the Italian stone cutters and stone builders that helped build the inn up there on the parkway, or off the parkway, I should say. There's a lot of history up there. There's a lot of stuff, I didn't know until I started traveling up in the area, but it's really interesting. I may be thinking about somebody else, but I'm pretty sure they were going to do a documentary about him and his granddaughter, or somebody was going to be doing some of the, talking about some of it on there. They may have already done it, but I don't recall what happened. Am I thinking about the same person, Bill, or somebody else?
I think you're right. Libby Kephart is his granddaughter that has been doing everything the last 10 years. And we had a Kephart day up in Clayton, Georgia, a few years ago. And they had a TV crew there. And they were interviewing her and interviewing different people and talking about, what an influence he had on the on just that whole region and on the bushcraft and everything. So I know they were filming it, but I don't know if it ever come out or if it did, how it was released. I know they released another book a couple years ago because she sent us a copy of it for our library that we have over in Watkinsville.
I think my son's got a couple of copies. I've got several of the books that were reprinted, but he found a copy. It might have been that flea marketplace there in Livonia. He's got a copy of an old one that was done back in the 30s. I think he's got an original copy. somewhere of one of his books, and I can't remember which one it is now. It wasn't our Southern Highlanders. It was one of the Game and Cookery or something series. I'm not sure which one it was, but it was one of the other ones about camping or cooking or something like that. I think it was one that was in it. It made it into one volume. It was two separate volumes. I think the guy out of Rock Hill, I can't remember the guy's name, that's same life. He was a professor. When my daughter was at Winthrop, he was a professor up there. I'm not sure if he's still living or not, but he has a lot of those things republished over the years. And I swear I can't remember his name now. It's on the tip of my tongue. But I met him several times over the years. But it seems like I did read something about that thing. I'm going to have to start Googling again to find out what happened to that documentary, because I'd be interested in seeing it. I don't know whether they actually made a DVD or I don't think it's broadcast on TV anywhere that I recall anyway.
Remember it being on TV, or if it was, it may have been on, you know, one of the History or Discovery Channel. They do a lot of those small documentaries, but I know they filmed for it, and I remember her talking about it, and it's been about 3 years ago, maybe four, I can't remember exactly, but it was a whole little festival just dedicated to Kett Park, and they had the folks there with the, I can't think of what you call them, but the canvas tents, and doing all the primitive camping, and everything, and had blacksmith there. It was a good little weekend up there in Clayton. It was cold. I remember that for sure. M4WHMID.
Back in the, I guess it's the late 60s when I got more interested in trout fishing. Used to travel up that area with. Try to find remote streams to fish with. They still had a few wild brook trout, but there weren't many of them left even then, but I think they've come back in some years now. But me and one of my buddies travel up in those areas, and we used to go up there a lot over the years, and you know, back in the 60s before Deliverance was filmed, you know, it was still real remote, and people hadn't caught on to the area like they did after Deliverance was filmed, along the Chattooga and some of those other creeks up in the area. But we'd run into mountain people all the time, and they hadn't changed in 100 years, I don't guess, but it was the same thing, you know, they talked the same and acted the same. It's not much difference in North Carolina, it's about the same way, but when you get up above Burnsville, North Carolina, there's kind of a different dialect up there. They don't, you know, it's up the Wonder, down the Wonder, the Ewens, and all that sort of thing. And I mean, they still use that dialect to this day. They don't change it at all. Even though they might have PhDs, they still talk that way when they're around their friends and relatives. But it's an interesting history, though. It's a lot of fun going back over the years. You know, Lynn's great uncle. He had a pharmacy somewhere up around Tiger or somewhere up in that area for years. And she and I were talking about it not long ago. I said, you know, there used to be a movie theater that a drive-in theater they reopened in Tiger for a while. I don't know whether it's still open or not, but somebody bought it and reopened the thing. They were showing movies during the summers at somewhere around, I think it's around Tiger. You know, I may be wrong about that too. My memory's not so hot anymore.
Radio, it'll do all kind of crazy stuff. I'm not sure about the drive-in. But you're right about the dialect. And we go up, it's been several years ago, but we used to go up to the Methodist Church Mission in Beverly, Kentucky. And that was some sure enough backwoods mountain living. I was astonished.
About HKX.
Hey, Jim. Me and Jerry, we're just talking about the dialect of the true mountain folks up in upper North Carolina, Virginia, Kentucky, up in that area. How it's still a viable language.
KN4VWA.
KO4HKX here. I was listening to y'all, and that's still very common around here where I live. I try to keep it in check a lot of times, but I still use that quite a bit when I'm around home.
Hey, Jerry. Information about me. Did you ever see the movie Coal Miner's Daughter? How about you, Patrick? And I don't know the other station in there, but Ted Webb was Loretta Lynn's daddy. My great-grandpa, Caney Webb, was Ted's brother. And I was born two ridges over from where Loretta was born. And that place was called East Point, Kentucky. And if y'all ever really want to hear the true dialect, just we'll get together sometime and I'll rattle it off on you.
Why are you as famous then?
Just for other reasons.
Bill, I was talking about, I used to travel to Burnsville a lot, did a lot of business up with a couple of plants up in the area. And it took me a while to catch on, but after I caught on, I started talking like them too. That way they could understand me. But it's just a different culture, and of course a lot of Cherokee still in the area up there, and a lot of have a lot of Cherokee in the background, and it's just the way it is. And you either learn it or you don't learn it, and you know, once you start talking a little bit like them, they start doing business with you.
And if you can meld the two of those and throw in a little bit of British in it, that's the roots of it.
Up 215 in that area, heading back up in there, and you're going to find some real backwoods.
When I went to Beverly, Kentucky to the mission, we would drive by and we'd look down the little hollers, and you'd see and I'm using a house very liberal here, the houses that they were living in, and there would always seem to be an outbuilding, and they were on up there in Beverly, Kentucky. It's on federal land, and they've got squatter rights, and as long as they have one structure, they could stay. And it was trial by fire. If you made your neighbor mad, they'd burn your little structure down, so you always had a second one, so you'd always have a place to say you were still there. It was quite an adventure up there.
We know where the rest of the bodies go? Rode down abandoned coal mine shafts.
A lot of coal mining up there. In my office, I've got a piece of coal that was shellacked, and it's got a red bow on it where that year we traded everything we were going to do for Christmas for a lump of coal from the mission up there in Beverly. And every time I see that, I think about the little kids that come up and give me that lump of coal in trade for Christmas gifts. It was a sad community, I tell you. It's hard to believe we still have that in today's society.
Well, if you have been up in that way, you know, it's that way in some areas for sure. I know there was I was still there. You used to have a Christmas train that went through the area up there, somewhere up there. It did up until a couple of years ago. I don't know where Norfolk Southern was running it or not, but with the coal production down, you know, they're not running as often as they were, but there was one area up there where they used to run through with a Christmas train through them stoppages and give out gifts. And, you know, the I don't think it's been done, but Raymond Western still does that here in the state. They have Christmas tree most every year when they stop at certain stops. I don't really give out any gifts or anything anymore, but they may have. I know they're in one last year because I got some videos of it coming through, but that was pretty common up in that part of the country. It probably still is in other parts too, I guess.
Beverly, we had to go up literally a path, and it would wash out from time to time, and that was the only way you could get into Beverly, Kentucky, was through that one little pass around the mountain. And if it was washed out, you had to do like a four-hour trip to come in from the other side. And all there, I mean, it was, the only thing that was there was the church, the mission, and the mission had a school and a doctor's clinic. And that was all there was for that whole area. It was quite a thing. And back in the 60s, the minister there actually got shot and killed by one of the parishioners because he didn't think the minister was doing right. And it's they mountain folks, they don't play. Carolina or Tennessee, Tennessee comes together, and it's all on federal land that was donated by Henry Ford, and there's no economic growth there or development there. It was all coal mines, and they shut them down back in the late 80s, early 90s, and that's about what I remember.
Okay, yeah, I remember that area. Harlan, Kentucky is southeast of Beverly, and my granddad worked in the coal mines, and he installed some of the first DC conveyor drives to get the coal out of the shafts. Before that, they had to use those little donkeys. That was back in about 1910, 1918, somewhere in there. And he was the first in the family to do electrical and electronic. My dad was the second, and now I'm third generation electrical electronic. I work on medical x-ray equipment, and my son is now fourth generation electrical electronic. He does electronics on military aircraft down in Florida.
Family trait to pass on, for sure. And that's some good history, no doubt. I started the first leg, and I guess the only leg since I don't have kids, into the technology field in my family. Everybody else grew up in Elberton and worked in the rock sheds, and I decided I didn't want to work in a rock shed, so I figured out how to work on computers for a living.
That's what happened with my dad. In that movie, if you remember, there's a line in the coal miner's daughter that says, "You either moonshine, coal mine, or you move on down the line." Well, Dad moved us on down the line. It's the best thing that ever happened to us. Got us out of that circle.
In and move on. It's hard to do, and that was one of the things I remember up in Beverly is they didn't like the school back in the old days because the kids were learning things that could take them away from home, and the kids were the retirement plan for the adults, just to stay there and take care of them and keep doing what they were doing. So it's, yeah, you had to coal mine, moonshine, or move on, and they didn't like that moving on too much sometimes.
Patrick, anything, by the way, about the pitch 100 on the CWID?
We'll keep looking and figure it out eventually.
set that thing up as a DT, send it as a DTMF down to. I'm not sure how to do that, but I think you could just. They had a thing you could hook onto a mic at one time. I did see that. That would send it out. You just key it up whenever you send it out. It would do it every 10 minutes. I don't think it's just whenever you keyed it up, it'd do it. But anyway, I'm going to do some more digging on it. Just want to let you know, I ain't forgot about you.
Hey, we just talked about it last night, so I didn't see you looking even mess with it yet.
I ain't got a whole lot to do. I always like to learn about different radios anyway. It's always good. Never know when I might have one myself when I change radios around. Anyway, I know you got everything hooked up. Hopefully we'll get that thing up on D-Star sometime soon. But Bill, I tell you what, that's some real tough looking stuff up there when you get through that kind of area. It's not, it makes Northeast Georgia look prosperous by comparison to some of the mountaineers up there. But I know it's tough to break that circle for sure. Especially when, like you said, that's something I just never thought about. You know, they are the retirement plan. That's very true, and I can see why they didn't want them leaving.
Righty. Gentlemen, I'm going to hop out. I'm going to say 7-3s here. Steve, Jerry, Bill, y'all all take care and have a good afternoon. KO4, HKX, clear.
Good afternoon, young man.
Behave yourself, Patrick.
Later on. And I'm going to jump out too, guys. I'm going in the new food line in Inman. Used to be the Bilo. Y'all have a good day, and don't drown. Game 4 VWA, clear.
7-3. Still around?
I am. I walked inside and got on the house radio. I was sitting outside before with my portable and just watching it rain. But I'm looking at the weather station here. I got, I'm showing 1.16 inches of rain we've gotten today, so that brings us to almost 2.5 inches for the month. So hopefully the rest of you gentlemen that just signed off will stay dry and be safe. And Jerry, back on the knives, you know, that custom GNS I got, I had LT make it special for me with a curly maple handles and dyed them with indigo blue and white liners. It's a, I made it sort of a one of a kind where if I laid my knife down, I could tell it apart from everybody else's.
Yeah, I'd like to see that one too sometime. I was thinking not long ago, you know, but I used to really like fixed blade, but got where it's hard to carry. And I had Burr Foster make me a little it was a laminated knife. It had I think it was oval one in the center and had stainless on the outside. And there's these scalloped edges. It looks like it's he does Damascus too, but he did this one for me. It was a little small one. It was kind of horizontal slip off pouch thing. I mean, that thing was ideal. I let somebody talk me out of that thing, and I tried to buy it back from him half a dozen times, and he won't even talk to me about it. But it was it was probably about 6 inches or 6.5 inches long, maybe. Probably six, I guess. And it had, it looked, I can't remember what he called it now, but it looked a little bit like a modified sharp finger, but it didn't have that, the play was just a little bit different than that, but it was kind of that same look. But it was a really good little knife. I enjoyed using it. I went to Blade Show and had it on one time, but I'm left-handed, so I had him make me up left-handed sheath. And one of the guys I knew, they said, "Why don't you sell me that thing, get Bert to boot make you another one?" And I said, and I thought about it a little while, and I said, I wouldn't mind having Bert build me a Damascus one, Damascus version of it. And then I sold it to him and went up to talk to Bert at the Blade Show, and he said, He said, Damascus. He said, I'll make you some. He said, but I'll do it. It may be a while. He used to deliver stuff pretty quick for me because I had several of his knives. And he was talking about 2.5, 3 years out, and I said, well, I guess we won't do that. But I did order one more from him, but it was a little nicer knife than the one I had, but I didn't really care for it that much. It didn't fit my hand very well. But that's good about the handles and all. And when you got somebody to make them up the way you want them, that's the way to do it.
I played with the GNS and decided that was the knife I wanted for my bushcraft, and just talked to LT, and they stay 6 to 9 months out, but he made mine that next week after the gathering, after we talked, and got it to me, and I got pictures of it being made and him, you know, shaping it and everything. So it's one I won't ever get rid of.
Yeah, sometimes you get lucky with a baker, and you know, they make it for you fairly soon. Tony Bowes' son Reese, he made me 5 or 6 knives. He was making one about one a year. But his normal wait's about 5, 6 years. But I got in good with him, and you know, I ordered simple stuff, nothing real complex. And of course, Tony passed away. He had a heart attack, passed away last year. So, you know, all his knives are just, you know, they've always run. You know, his knives are jig bone and nicer handle materials. Have always bought a couple of $1,000. Now I see them, some of them asking as much as 3 for them. And Reese's are a little less expensive, but his knives start out about $600 just for basic micarta and go up from there. But those things, that's one of those things you may not make money on them, but you ain't going to lose money on them. It's that sort of thing. But I don't keep anything I won't use, so I use all mine. That's, I don't get any enjoyment out of sitting there looking at them.
I agree with you. If I'm gonna own it, I'm gonna use it, and I don't have any. Some people call them safe queens. I've got 2 little knives that were made by a local knife maker here in Hartwell, Gerald White. He used to do vinyl siding, and I got those, and they're just mirror polished. And one's camel bone and one's red stag. They're just like, total length is probably 3.5 inches. They are little display knives, but the every other knife I got is a working knife, that's for sure.
I think I made it better. I got a lot of them I probably should have hung on to over the years, because some of these makers have just escalated in value so much, it's just unreal. And what I paid, there's still a lot of money, but what I paid $500-$600 for some of them, you know, sometime my other knives, I had a left-hand Damascus, folder of his that he built for me. It was a minute angle deal where he drills holes in a minute angle holes, like a rifle. And I think I saw that. I sold it to a friend of mine. I think I saw it change hands again not long ago for about $4,000. But I should have just hung on to mine. But I just can't. I can't afford to buy them and keep all of them. I have to get rid of some of them when they get in that price range.
That price range will still be out of my range. I'm hard pressed to put that much into a knife. Maybe later on, but not right now. The most of the knives I deal with are around 300 or less. But like I said, I haven't bought a knife in several years, other than just some small pocket knives or something like that, since I got that GNS and that Dogwood custom neck knife.
Right one, you know, you kind of stop looking for other stuff. But I get on a kick. This has been, like I said, this has been, I think the last one I bought from Tom was probably 12 years ago. And I was still messing around with traditional slip joint eyes then, but I was doing with lesser known makers, and because the wait list was so long for Bose knives, and you could get the case versions of some of the knives, but they just weren't, you know, they weren't anywhere near as good. But he quit taking I was on his books for about 10 years, and he finally just, you know, gave up on the books, started making what he wanted to make. But yeah, he's, like I said, he's gone now. But that's one of those things that happens. They get so many people, they get so far behind, they just, you know, they said, well, if that's it, I'm making what I want to make, and sell them as I make them. And it's kind of tough on the people being on the list all that long waiting, but that's the way it goes sometimes. But a lot of these other guys deliver pretty soon, but they just, some of these guys have gotten famous so quickly, and I guess so many people, younger people, have gotten interested in traditional type knives and fixed blade knives. They just driven the prices up, and the guys get orders. And next thing you know is, you know, they got a good knife, they sell for, you know, a couple $100 or so. Next thing you know is $500. Then just 2 years waiting, and next thing you know is, you know, they only sell at shows after that, or they do lotteries and that sort of thing. It takes the joy out of it. But if you get them when they first start making it, it's a good knife. It's, you can get a good deal on them. It's worth having them, especially if it's something, you know, you really like. It fits you well and it does what you want it to do. That's really what knives are all about anyway. N4DJC Friday.
4WHMID. Yeah, you're right, Jerry. The like I said, once you find what you're looking for, you kind of stop looking. There's some knives I'd love to own. There's some local knife makers that come to our gatherings every fall, and they bring in some beautiful custom knives, and they always, what we do is we work out as part of the agreement for coming and being able to sell and do whatever, is they have to sort of buy a booth, kind of like they do at Blade Show, and it's not near that expensive, but what we ask them for is either monetary payment or in trade. And so a lot of times we'll get, you know, a $200-$400 knife from them, and we raffle them off, and you know, it's a good raffle at the end of the event we have every year. We usually have $4,000 to $5,000 worth of gear that we raffle off, and people can get tickets for $2 a piece and put them in the bucket in front of the item, and we have a little kid come down through and draw the names, and sometimes you don't win, sometimes you win. We've had one guy win twice, two knives from the table, so it's all chance, and they get some real nice equipment that way.
Well, most of these top tier makers do it blade now. They'll raffle off a chance to buy it at the table price, whatever it is. And Tony and Reese, when they were, Reese had, you know, they hadn't been to the show in a couple of years, and Reese don't like to go anyway. He may not go, you know, since Tony passed away now, but they'd have 15 or 20 knives, and you put your name on the back of the card for a certain knife, you know, and they'd have, like I said, they might have 15 knives, and they just gave you an opportunity to buy it for what they sell it for at the table price, not the aftermarket price. But even then, some of the knives were pretty damn expensive. I know several years ago he had a Damascus ivory handled called it a Lanny's clip, and it's one of his more famous patterns, slip joint. And the guy that won the chance to buy it, somebody went up and got the knife. They paid for it, but they got the knife and under this guy's name somehow or another, but they did have to pay for it. But anyway, there's all kinds of stuff going on at these shows like that. But a lot of them use, they use text lotteries now too, which is really unusual. But that's a chance for somebody to get a knife at a table price rather than having to pay some huge aftermarket price for some of these really, really top tier makers. It's a good thing. I mean, I've never won an opportunity to buy one, so I can't say I like it all the time. But it's a way for somebody to get one at a table price instead of paying four times that for a dealer.
That's not a bad thing to do. I know, like I said, some of the folks, the Casey that I do Georgia Bushcraft with, he's been going to Blade Show for many years, and I've heard a lot of stories about the way things go on and carry on. He does everything he can to convince me to go, but I don't know. I might get in there and I might get crazy and I'd be and bought an expensive knife and then I'd have buyer's remorse probably on the way home.
Thing about Blade is if you get a knife from somebody, and I've had people try to buy knives away from me before I left the show, and you know, give me double what I paid for it sometimes, or an extra $100 or something just to get it, because people come in there and some of these knives are just not available, so they can make a profit on reselling them. And the thing about most of these top tier makers, they don't care. They just know what they got in it. If you sell it for twice what you pay for, they don't care. There's a lot of people, of course, don't like that, but some guys have got more money. I know a lot of guys come there. One in particular, I used to hang around with some. A lot of cash. I mean, a lot of cash on him, because a lot of them, they won't take cards or checks. You got to pay in cash. Seeing somebody flip out $5,000 for a knife and then have somebody else try to buy it from them for 10 or 15 is just unreal. But some of them are that expensive. It's one of those things where it's like buying these exotic cars. They're just so expensive. Nobody but a few people can buy them, but the ones that can buy them, they get into bidding competition for them. They'll pay way too much for it, but then they just have that. It's something that drives them to get it, and they don't care how much it costs sometimes.
4WHMID. Yeah, some people definitely got more money than sense. I mean, they get in that bidding war, and they'll pay an unbelievable amount for things. I've had people try to buy stuff from me that I have and offer me way more than it's worth. But most of the stuff I have now has been whittled down over the years to it's exactly what I want, and it works just how I want it to, and I don't particularly want to get rid of it. So now everything has a price, but sometimes it has to be awful high.
If it's a common item, it's not a big deal, but most of the stuff I got is not common, and it probably could be replaced. It could be replaced, but it'd be some of them I had to wait several years, and I don't know whether I got several years left or not, but I had to wait several years to get it replaced, and so I just hang on to them, and then let somebody else worry about it after I'm gone. But I've sold some, especially the modern folders and stuff. I sold a bunch of those over the years. I made enough money to buy more. It's surprising sometimes, but I had people offer me the money for it, and I said, okay. And all they did was finance another knife for me at some point in the future or then. But what I got now probably can't be. Most of them, with a custom knife, they could be replaced, but it may take years to replace them. And I sure can't replace them with what I got in them, that's for sure. And some of them from some of these other makers, you can't replace them now. Like the Mayos that my son's got one Mayo that I bought, and that knife couldn't be replaced. I mean, time would be making that particular model anymore or not. And he's only done lotteries now, so chances of getting one would be 10,000 to one, so that can't be replaced. It was, just hang on to it, because I didn't pay much for that one. And like I said, it's like that way with custom knives. You got one you like, you might be able to get another one like it, and then again, you may not. I just don't, once you know what you want, that's just it. Man, stick with it.
Very true. Well, Jerry, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to grab me some lunch and see what needs to be done around here. So I've enjoyed talking with you. Hope you stay home and stay dry the rest of the day. I'll probably be back on the radio this afternoon. If you're around, I'll holler at you. But always good to talk to you. I'll tell everybody here that you were on the radio. They always like to hear about our conversations. So hope you're doing well. Hope you continue to do well. 73 is my friend. This is M4WHM. I'll be clear on your phone.
Same to you and your family. We'll try to stay dry this afternoon. I'm not planning on going back out again, but you never know. But anyway, take it easy. Probably talk to you a little bit later on this evening. N4DJC, clear.
4DJW, mobile.